So my name is Arthur Boutelis. I'm an interviewer with the Institutions for Fragile States. I'm now sitting with Neil Pouliot at the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the Gendarmerie Royale du Canada, in Ottawa, Canada. Today is January 15th, 2008. Well, first, thank you very much for your time. Before we start the interview, can you please confirm that you've read, understood, and signed the informed consent and the legal release form?
I did read it and I signed it.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me start by asking a little bit more about your personal background and the different jobs you've held before, and how did you come about overseas, and how did you get involved into police reform work overseas?
Well, I joined the Mounted Police in 1962. From Niagara Falls, Canada, and I was did my training in Regina, Saskatchewan. Upon completion of my training in Saskatchewan, I was sent to northern Manitoba, a place called Thompson, where I was involved in uniform policing of the town of Thompson as well as the outlying areas of the city. And my mode of travel was by motor gas car on the railroad track. After 5 years there, I was transferred to Montreal, where I participated in almost 5 years of drug investigations. From there, I was transferred to Ottawa, to the Canadian Police College, where I was course coordinator and lector for drug investigational techniques and counterfeit investigational techniques courses. Upon completion of that term, I was transferred to Regina, Saskatchewan, where I participated in the white-collar crime investigations for 3 years. And I was in charge of the drug squad in Regina for 4 years. Upon completion of that task, I was commissioned and came to Ottawa as the officer in charge of national and international drug operations. And as such, I was responsible for coordinating and participating in some international investigations in Canada, the United States, and other countries around the world. As well, during that time, I was a resource person for United Nations Division of Narcotics and Interpol in giving courses in, on drug investigational techniques, or parts of courses in investigational techniques in developing countries, in Africa and in India, and in Malaysia as well. I participated in that program of drug investigations for 6 years, 7 years, and I was appointed the officer in charge of Security Offenses Branch, which is a part of the Criminal Intelligence Directorate here in Ottawa that overlooked terrorist activity and prosecuting cases involving terrorist activity, such as Air India, that type of thing. I did that for several years, and I was appointed the Director of Criminal Intelligence Services Canada, which was responsible for coordinating intelligence throughout Canada between different police forces and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, as well as internationally. And during that time, I participated in lectures around the world, the last one being giving a presentation on police corruption in Beijing, China. I gave courses in Chile, as well dealing with the intelligence community, okay, on police responsibility, dealing with intelligence. Why I took this job as a director of the UN Commission in Haiti, I had applied earlier. I always thought that I could maybe help in assisting a war-torn country, if you want, as I had been in a number of African countries, developing countries. I had applied for a job through the force in Cambodia, I believe it was at the time, but the government of Canada did not participate in that particular venture. And when Haiti became open, I applied for that, and I got the job, and I was there for 17 months I was there initially as the part of the reconnaissance team in arriving in Haiti much earlier than the mission and doing a reconnaissance of the country to establish what were the requirements of the country, manpower, the legal system, et cetera, et cetera. And then we took over, and I was there for over a year as the Union Commissioner of 21 different countries who participated in the mission.
What were the exact dates, if I may ask, or at least a year?
I have in my CV, but it's September 1994. I went to Haiti, September 1994, and we had to prepare a report for the commissioner, or for the UN, by December of 94.
And that's the reconnaissance mission.
Yes. And that was part of it, and it went into 95 as well. And we took over, I believe it was May 1st or April 30th, 95, from the multinational team that was already there.
Can you describe briefly, like the history, because you come really with the reconnaissance team, and you see the first steps really of that mission?
Well, we weren't given any literature per se prior to getting there. When I knew I was going to be going to Haiti, I went to the library and gathered as much literature as I could to read up on the status of the country, having known or heard about some of it in the past. And when we were there, we were to determine if it was a stable and safe environment and what was required to make a stable and safe environment. We went to, I believe it was 120 of the 125 communes on the island, and found that, well, in most police stations, I would say that 98% of them, of all the police stations we visited, there were no criminal codes. There were no documentations. Just some of the things that we saw there, the men, women, and children were locked up in the same cells. Some of the crimes that they had committed were not registered. Some of the officers, when asked why these people were in jail, they couldn't tell us. They couldn't tell us the names of some of these people. Another sideline that we found was that none of the prisoners were fed by the police or by the state. It was a requirement of the families to feed their own. And that's pretty well kind of a common thing I found with many, many countries in Africa, especially from the Franco Napoleonic law type countries, and that it was the family's responsibility to feed the prisoners. In any event, we found this in many, many places, eventually when we come into place, we're able to get the government to make a separation of jails from the police and set up a directorate for the prisons that was answerable to the minister, but separate from the police. We were able to get food for the prisoners from an NGO at the time, the Bureau de Nutrition and Development. They supplied the food. We had to obtain it in Port-au-Prince and delivered it to all the jails. We found out very shortly after we brought the food to the prisoners that halfway through the month, the food was gone. And then we asked the civilian police, my police, how come there's no food? Well, what they were doing, they would gather the food at the beginning of the month and bring it, give it to the police at the police stations, and the police ate the food as well with the prisoners. Therefore, lack of food, and we had to change our policies and dole out the food on a daily basis until things got corrected. I mean, these things don't correct themselves overnight, and they don't correct themselves in the year. It takes a lot of time. As you know, you can teach young people many, many things, and they're enthusiastic to learn it, but if they're the next phase is that if they are placed with people who have been there for a long time, they're not prepared to change their ideas, so the young people will not change it. And as well, if the president of the country, the ministers, are not prepared to change their ideologies, others won't change it either. So we're looking at a 200-year problem that, you know, the old saying is that he who's in power grabs everything while he's there because tomorrow he may be gone. And that is, I believe, a problem in Haiti as well as many other developing countries in Africa and South America.
Could you talk a little bit about the status of public order and crime when you first got there during the assessment mission?
Okay. When we were first there, there was so much military. There were 25,000 troops in Haiti, most in Port-au-Prince, that for the first 4 or 5 months there was no crime because there was so much military. But as the military began to get reduced in the multinational force, crime started to go up. But we found that in many cases, because there was no legal system in place, that the population took matters in their own hands. Either people were macheted to death or stoned to death or beaten to death by the general population. And it was seemed to be an acceptable thing. And I go back to the fall of 1994 when the multinational forces came into Haiti and the people were lined up on the streets welcoming the soldiers. And on the sidelines were the FAD. You know who they are,
yeah.
Okay. The FAD, who are the police, the FAD. They were on the streets and people were cheering and crowding. And the FAD just turned around and beat these women back. This is on television, beat them back out of the way. And the women were laughing. And it seems to be an accepted thing at that time that beatings from the military or those in authority was a common accepted thing. So this is the things we saw. It's very hard to accept. You just don't go beating people. It's not the way to make things work. But that was some of the things. There was no justice, as I say. The chef d'instruction was the all-powerful person. If a body was found on the street, nobody could move it until you got a juge d'instruction. And in most cases, in order to find a juge d'instruction, the phones weren't working. You had to go get somebody to take you one. It could take a whole day. In the meantime, that body remained there, and the animals start pecking at it, eating at it, the pigs, right, the dogs, the chickens. It's a common thing. And what the police, before we arrived there, these are things I heard, but when someone was found on the street, the police say, well, he's still a little bit alive when we take him to the hospital. As long as that person was still a little bit alive, take him to the hospital, but in essence, the person was dead. But they thought in order for them to be presumed dead, they would have to get a medical person to say that. And as far as they were concerned, they were still alive. But when multinational forces came, it didn't happen. Bodies stayed on the street. So those are the type of things that are very real.
Can you clarify for us, what was your mandate as you came in as superintendent chief commissioner in Haiti from 94 to 96? Is that correct?
I came in 94, but I didn't take over officially the United Nations mission until the 30th of April.
Okay.
The mandate became official on the 30th of April from the UN.
95.
Yeah.
And then through 96.
And through 96.
So can you walk us through the initial steps of how, what your mandate was, what the mission was,
okay,
on the police side of things?
The mandate was to assist the government of Haiti maintain a safe and secure environment and to assist the government in elections and to assist in training a police force. However, the mandate for me as a police officer assisting the government of Haiti to maintain a safe and secure environment was very, very hazy. And I sent a fax off to New York asking what details. In fact, I said if a person was beating, a Haitian was being beaten or by fellow Haitians and the local authorities would not step in, what is my authority? What are the authorities for the United Nations Police? Because I felt that having been sent there by my government, that if this was on television, the Canadians would be very irate that we, Mounted Police, would be standing by doing nothing. So the United Nations came back and told us that we could take a proactive action in arresting that person and turning him over to a justice as soon as possible. And the rules of engagement were all laid out, what we could do as far as firearms is concerned, the whole nine yards. So in essence, while we were there, we were doing the police with the existing interim public security force, because when we took over, the FOD had been, many of the FOD had been accused of human rights violations. And they had been recorded by a number of embassies, as well as of the MICV mission. MICV, I think you know what MICV, okay. So a lot of the FOD were vetted, were rejected because of the human rights violations. Now, while these people were being rejected, they had to be given some kind of training to get them back into the workforce. And some of the training included training in computers, mechanical maintenance, and there was another one that slips my mind. But you know, computer enhancements, and when half the power, three quarters of the country is not in power, is kind of a. They weren't good things. I think there was a good intention, but they weren't good things. I mean, you demobilize these people, you have to give them real jobs that they can do. And I don't think that was really being done at that time. I think it was more or less a, what's the word I'm looking for? Saving the face type of thing, a pacifier, because they were getting money as well for a few months after. So the vetted FOD became the interim public security force, okay? And they were mixed in with Guantanamo Bay trainees. Those are people who had been picked up by ship, okay, trying to get away from Haiti and brought in Guantanamo Bay. So a lot of them were given police training of several months by ISATAP and brought into the full with the FOD and made the interim public security force. The stations were not equipped. There was no, most of the police, these officers had no guns. If they did, they had no bullets. They were antiquated weapons. The communication system, the police cells didn't work. The plumbing didn't work. The toilets were non-existent. The places were technically pigsties. And we had to work with these people in these places. And so some of the things and recommendations we made were to have United Nations fix up these stations and fix up whatever we could to get it done. There were contracts that had been laid out to fix different places like Cap Haitien and other cities, and the work just didn't seem to get done. A lot of these people, contractors, wanted to be paid up front before the work was done. In a lot of cases it wasn't done. And so these are the existing situations we had to live in and work with these people. And most of the time, the arrests and when there's demonstrations, etc., the interim public security force were falling down. Although some of them did do very good jobs, they tried with the training they were given. But they knew at the end of the day, they were going to be replaced by the new police force, because Aristide did not want any people from the FOD in the police force. So they were going to be replaced. Now, we were faced with a dilemma that the first 700 police officers were going to graduate in June of 95. And we had to demobilize 700 of the interim public security force. Now, we set up an evaluation system for the police officers done on a weekly basis at all the stations. And we asked the CIFPOL to do these evaluations. And then they were brought into Port-au-Prince, where they were all evaluated. And the worst 700 performers in all of Haiti, not one location, but of all of Haiti, were to be demobilized. The list was given to the governor of Haiti for their approval. They came back and refused a portion of the people that had been recommended to be demobilized. And I asked them why, and the answer from the government was that these people were Guantanamo Bay trainees, and they were loyal to Haiti, to Aristide, and had to stay. Now, these people, the reason why they were, their performance appraisals were terrible in that they didn't show up for work, or if they came, they were late, they wouldn't wear their uniforms. They were just very, very lazy and not really interested. But those are the type of people that we refused. Now, Mr. Aristide and his entourage had made recommendations or suggestions that they would keep all the Guantanamo Bay trainees and put them as presidential guards, if you want, that type of thing. So this is the type of dilemma we're faced with. Plus, other problems that crept up were that the persons in charge of chaque département, I can't remember the name now, but it was a person in charge of each department, like each province or each state, was appointed by Mr. Aristide. In many cases, no police experience, no legal system, and just an appointment. In one place, Jacques Mel, that gentleman took 40 new police recruits who were supposed to work with United Nations civilian police the population and made them his personal bodyguards. And he commented, and if you know that, maybe you don't know, the Japanese had donated, I think, 200 vehicles, police vehicles. This gentleman took these vehicles. I think he left two for the whole place of Jacques Mel, for the whole province, if you want, and the rest of them he took for himself and his 40 police officers, the bodyguards. Now, this was all recommended, reported, and given to Mr. Brahimi, and when we had meetings with the president, we met him twice a week. All these things were brought to him, filtered to him. Nothing changed. Nothing changed.
When you were reporting this back to headquarters in New York, what were the recommendations made?
Well, from us or from, well, we had
CIFPOL's.
Well, CIFPOL, I took my orders from Mr. Brahimi, and we went to the president to get this change. And, we'll look at it, we'll look at it. Those are the type of questions, just like discipline. Discipline, like this, for example, another problem. We had Canada, and this is a political thing, decided to give training to Haitians here in Regina, Saskatchewan. And I can't remember the number, but they took quite a few, I think a couple hundred Haitians from the United States and Canada and were sent to Saskatchewan for training. A lot of them, many of them, were recommended to be not to go on, but because it was a political thing, they had to stay. And the only thing we could vet them on was a criminal record or a national security record if we had any. That was the only clearance. We couldn't meet relatives, we couldn't meet friends to find out, go to school records to find out what kind of individual this was. So these people were engaged in a very high salary, American dollars, and brought back to Haiti during the time before the new police recruits came out, before they came out, and were housed with them at the same school that they were getting training. And we found out that these trained Canadian police officers, or Haitians, were telling the Haitians, are you working for this? Here's how much we're getting. Causing a lot of problems with the new recruits. And it turns out that a lot of these people, before the new recruits came out, were working for the government, and they became members of SIN.
SIN, which stands for?
Service d'Intelligence Nationale.
National Intelligence Service.
SIN, remember that. So a lot of these people were police officers during the day, and they were sinning at night. Because what they start doing is they start kidnapping people, beating them up, threatening them. And when this came to light, we found out. In fact, a couple of times our new police officers were going to have gun exchanges. And there were shots fired, but nobody, thank goodness, no one was hit. And so we went to see Aristide, and we said, with Rahimi, with all this in hand, and sin was dissolved. It was just taken out. But those are the type of things that that come up on you that you're not prepared for, or you wouldn't accept to happen when a new president comes into power, or think it would, especially when he's a priest. I shouldn't say that.
So we already got into the issue of recruitment. Before we really go more in depth in the technical areas,
yes.
I'd like maybe if you could walk us through the rest of your career and maybe this past 10 years since you've been in Haiti, especially if you had any other overseas involvement, in what capacity?
Well, training in a lot of developing countries with Interpol and United Nations or Divisions for Narcotics. But it's a two-week course, so you give this the development of informants, you talk about that, investigational techniques, how to conduct searches, that type of thing. So you give that session a couple of days, some of them reenact it. As far as going beyond that, how they carried out in their own country, I don't know. But I do know that in my experience in Senegal, I did a study of the airport there, the international airport, because they were saying it was a transshipment point. And they had 16 members working there. And so I had recommended to the director of the National Police that perhaps they could have shift work. Maybe three shifts, so they could cover all the other people coming in and out of the airport, or people coming in. And the director said to me, he says, "Well, sir, you have to understand that we're not paid very much here. And in order to combat corruption, we try to keep everybody working together so nobody can do anything without the others knowing it." Real story.
That's one way.
Yeah, in Slovakia, where I spent a year, I made recommendations through the country and how to implementing methodologies in order to combat organized crime, and that was involved in suggesting policies, basing myself always in the failures of my country, how we did things and what happened when we did them in a certain way, and recommending them to do it a different way, but leaving the option to them. I lectured the criminal operations officer, which was number two in the police force, as well as the different commanders of each province, and different enforcement groups, organized crime, drugs, that type of thing, and how we did things, and the informant development, the witness protection program, undercover operations, and how we do it, and how it operates in our country, and how it could possibly operate in their country. I delivered 65 presentations and papers while I was there in a year. They were all translated and put in the library and at the police library at the main training school in Bratislava. So my presentations were translated. Approximately 1 week before I got there, my presentations were prepared and given to the person who were going to translate. They were to read them. We would meet 2 days before to discuss to see if they had any problems. Like, for example, I said sometimes police have a tendency to cut corners. And the translator didn't understand what cutting corners was. So when I drew a four-cornered street and showed her that instead of going this way, they would take a shortcut, then she understood. She said, "We have a term for that. So it's things like that that were very important, that when you're presenting, that the meaning is presented, not just the dialogue. And probably that's a problem with a lot of missions and not understanding.
Okay. Let's move on to more technical areas. What we're primarily interested in, I think, is your involvement in Haiti. But if you have any other relevant experience internationally in police reform, then we're happy if we can make compromises and other things. So as we already touched on the recruitment issues.
Okay, go ahead.
Maybe I'd like to move on from recruitment to training and professionalization. In Haiti, I was going to ask you if you could maybe describe some of the training programs that you may have designed and if you started implementing them.
Okay. The training programs were developed by ISATAP, the training programs at the school. Mm-hmm. And there were Canadians delivering those programs. Okay, they were members of ISATAP, but not part of my United Nations missions. They were separate and apart. However, what we did was we developed a field training guide based on what they had learned at the academy. Now, the objective of the field training guide, I saw it as threefold. If the when the young officer came out of training, he had a manual. Each officer had a manual, training manual, or field based on what he had learned. My CIVPOL officer was to accommodate these young people to see how they perform those duties that they had learned at the academy. Now, if that officer or other officers were not meeting the criteria as laid out in the norm, the field training guide, then we knew we had a problem at the school. If the errors that that particular person was committed and it was not the same as the others were not committing those errors, then the problem was with that young person, and that had to be corrected. And as a United Nations commander, it was important that I find out how my officers were participating with these people, because they would have to make notes in this field training guide. It demanded a lot of them. A lot of them would have maybe 5 or 6, maybe 10 trainees under his watch. But that's what we're there for, to work. It wasn't a holiday. That's one of the things that we had done. And that would have been 4 months, because he had 4 months of training at the school and a 4 month training guide. It went along pretty good. I had resistance from some of the United Nations police officers because they thought it was labor intensive and it was demanding. But I had some that came after me and said, gosh, that's a wonderful thing. We should do that in our own country.
What capacity did you have with CIVPOL to do this follow-up 4 months training in the field?
I was the commissioner of the United Nations Police. Mm-hmm. So I had training officers working under me, a training officer and an administrative commander and a criminal operations commander. So those are the things that I put forward and had my staff develop in working with these people. Now, a lot of these things were put in place before we actually took over the mission. But these were all preparation between the time we were a reconnaissance team and the time we took over. These were all things that we were working on a daily basis. Like, for example, the recruiting of Haitians to become police officers was criteria developed by my staff at UN. And because I had French-speaking members, they went out to interview people across the country, along with the members from ISATAP. But it was basically UN personnel working in conjunction with ISATAP and other agencies to get this thing going. I think when you go on a mission, you got to figure, you got to take your ego and put it in your pocket, and you have to work with everybody there in order to make the mission work. You're not there for yourself, you're there for the country. And sometimes people forget that. CIVPOL forgets it, the military forgets it, the administration staff of the United Nations forget it, NGOs forget it. We're all there to work for achievement of the mission, the country. And people have a hard time with their ego, okay? But that's some of the things that we experience, okay? For example, driver training was not taught in the training.
In the academy. ISATAP training.
That's right. And now we're not talking about sophisticated driving. There are no paved roads in Haiti, okay? It's all pretty well goat trails. First gear, second gear, third gear, you know, anywhere else about 40 kilometers would be maybe a 30-minute drive. Sometimes we're looking at 3 hours in Haiti to get some of these places. So we weren't talking about sophistication. And because my manpower was spread out, I had 900 officers spread out through 19 locations in Haiti, plus Paul Plains were in five or six offices in the city. My manpower was dispersed. And I had to blend my people because not everybody was French-speaking. Okay, that's the other problem. And some were not even English-speaking. Okay, so that was another problem. So I had to put English and French and people spoke Spanish and different languages together. Like, for example, I was fortunate enough that I had Canadians that spoke English, French, and Spanish. So I put them along the Dominican Republic border, along with some of the Argentinians, okay, and some other nationalities who spoke maybe French or English. But you got to remember, I had 147 Jordanians that very few spoke English or French. I think I had one more Jordanian spoke French, maybe half a dozen spoke English. Same with the Argentinians. Two spoke French, one spoke English, the rest is all Spanish. The Pakistanis, a couple spoke English, the rest, no.
So how did you go about working with them? Did you have translators?
Okay, what I did is I blended my missions. For example, I'll give you one mission I had. Bangladeshis, Pakistanis, Jordanians, French, okay, and some English. So my orders always left the station in both English and French. So in this case here, it went to the French and Algerians. I had an Algerian. That's what it was. I had French who spoke to the Algerian in French. The Algerian spoke to the Pakistani, okay, in Arab. And the Pakistani spoke to the Bangladeshi in English. Or that's how we try to make things work. Okay, it wasn't always perfect, but that's how we had to make it work. And as I said, you had to blend your weaknesses and strengths to give a product that was the same across the country. But those are some of the things that we had to live with. Now, as far as a training aspect, when I left in February 29, 1996, I was replaced by another country. And the first thing they did was no more field training guide. All the training was to be done from the station. So how do you monitor a young officer in the station for his weaknesses and strengths based on a training guide? So that's where I think it started falling up. Some of that started falling apart.
Was that a personal initiative, or is this was there some kind of handover between you and your successor, or were the guidelines?
The guidelines—that's what I'm frustrated with, because all this that I did, or my team did, was sent to the UN, who had sanctioned it. A new commissioner comes along, and he changes at his whim. As I can see it, the continuity is not there. It's thrown out. It's not the way we do things in my country. Because not many countries do this field service training, which I think is a very, very good way to get things done. So that was one of the training. We also try to give, I know I went and participated in giving management courses to some of the senior officers or in the new police force. But you got to remember, some of these senior police officers were very young. And they were promoted on as a result of exams. Experience was very, very minute because they're all new police officers. There was no seasoned officer there to look after. The only seasoned officers were the UN. And some of that sometimes was questionable too. I'll give you an example. Before a new police force came in, we were doing the policing with the interim public security force. And one of someone had been arrested, a Haitian national had been arrested, and the interim public security force, the FOD, the former FOD, were giving this guy a licking. One of my UN officers, who was an observer and a trainer, was in the office sitting there looking and saying nothing. The commanding officer for the Port-au-Prince happened to come into the station, because he roved around unannounced. Come into the station, he saw what was happening. He stopped it, and he asked the UN police officer, why didn't you do anything? He said, well, it's no different than home. Okay. Now, you got to remember, the UN asks for police officers from democratic countries. So what is democratic to mean? Democratic to you may not be totally democratic to some of these other people, but a lot of these people, these countries apply and they get the job. There's a couple of factors I want to point out. When military and police are deployed on mission, the UN pays a big chunk of money to the contributing countries per month. It's a big business for some of these countries. Bangladesh, Pakistan, India. It's a big business. And that's why they're so readily to supply manpower. And you get a lot of it from developing countries. I had a contingent of 20 officers. They came in from Guinea-Bissau. Didn't speak English, didn't speak French. They arrived with no uniforms and no firearms. And I was supposed to take these people in. Okay. Already, that was a handicap. If I had to put them out, and I couldn't keep them on Paul Price all the time. By the time I got my everything done to get them back out of there, it took a month. I had to get them to the United Nations. They go back to the country. It took a month to get them out. So while they're there, get them to do something. But my officer's saying, I'd rather not go out. They can't do anything. They can't speak the language. We can't speak to them. Have our backs up. But those are the real things that happen. I'm probably mixed up here some of this stuff, but
if I can come back to the training for a moment. You mentioned because you're involved mainly in the field, sort of like the follow-up training in the field. You mentioned driving as one of the categories.
So
do you have any other?
So the driving wasn't done at the academy. So I got the military. I got the general. I spoke to the general, asking them to give training to my police officers, and he said he'd be happy to do that. And I got some of my police officers saying, "Why are you doing this?" And I'm saying, "They're getting training on how to drive. We're not talking about pulling people over. We're just people to drive." I said, look at 5% of the police force can drive. Only 5% of the police force can drive. We have to have drivers. We can't have these same 5% be working all the time, because that's what's starting to happen. So that was one of the things. Another thing was I had the military do a study in the communication system. And again, resistance from within. Why can't that? It's a police responsibility. So, well, what do you mean? Communication is a police responsibility? Come on. So I got them to do recommendations, and because there had been police communications in that country before, it was all broken down. So I said, let's get a study done. Maybe we can get some of these things fixed and it'll work for what we need and what we have, just like the plumbing. Fix the stations up. We don't have to build new stations. Let's fix them up, clean them up, and they'll have someplace to go and have a maintenance. That's another thing, maintenance. It seems to be a word that doesn't exist in Haiti or in other developing countries, maintenance. Seems to have been removed from everybody's vocabulary because, things are always broken down. Eh? So that was some of the things. Management courses, some of the officers.
When we talk about internal management, that's another category. We talk about promotion system, disciplinary system, record keeping, accounting, and so on. Can you tell us a little bit more about the instances where you've assisted the Haitian police in developing this?
The internal discipline, that was another major problem where incidences have been reported regarding the conduct of the Interim Public Security Force and later some of the palace guards and then the new police. And it was all documented for the Ministry of Justice to take an action. And it was always what I call a Haitian oui. I don't know if you know what a Haitian yes is. And I think it goes back to the days that they were slaves, because they never say no to the master. They always say yes. But is it a real yes or a Haitian yes? And most times it's a Haitian yes. Never got done. and you recorded it. Another problem with discipline. The police stations were responsible for licensing vehicles. In a couple of places, some of the new vehicles we got, the country got or received, the police license plate with private license plates and start using the vehicles for their families, private families. This was reported again to take an action by the government. Very, very slow. By the time I left, many of the problems with discipline had not been resolved. And I think that we have to have a mechanism in place that when something happens, you want the host country to be responsible and to take an action, but if they don't, then the UN should be empowered to do something, or the organization should be empowered to take the necessary action that they would like in their own country. But the United Nations has to have some kind of a court set up in order to do that, as they would in your own country. It's not something that's going to take, because if an improper action occurs and you sit on it and do nothing, it only encourages the others to do the same, because they know no action will be taken. When there's a disciplinary problem, it has to be acted on quickly. And the rest of the rank and file have to see that an action has been taken, that it will not be tolerated. Because when you start tolerating it, it opens doors to other misdeeds.
You said there needs to be a mechanism. Is that something you tried in the field?
No, I never tried it because I wasn't there long enough to get that in place. Just trying to keep things going. And having been new with the UN, if you want, in DPKO side, was an experience in itself. And I had to demobilize starting in November of 95. I had to demobilize 900 officers down to 300 because the mission was going to continue, but was coming up on the 29th of February for extension. But I had to reduce it. And so plans are put in place to reduce down to 300 by February. And one of my recommendations was that we charter an aircraft and take the Pakistanis, the Jordanians, the Bangladeshis, and the Nepalese on one flight. I got resistance from that, from New York. And I said, well, why can't we do this? I said, we're going to save the United Nations a lot of money. Because I said, if they go commercially from Haiti, they're going to go to the United States. From the United States, they have to go to Britain or France. A lot of these countries are going to have visas. And we're going to have to pay for those things. I said, if we take one flight, we leave Haiti, and we go to Jordan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal. Well, you know what the bottom line was? I finally got it out of them. They had never done it before. So they were afraid to ask. I finally got the plane, but I had to keep at it. But this is how I had to do long-term planning and keep only the French-speaking members in and stuff like that. But it was...
So it actually happened. There was this plane who did this.
I'm sorry?
The plane actually happened.
Oh, yeah, the plane in to took all these people on in one trip.
You mean, with the story of the plane, makes me come back to another question of possible. All this training initiatives and recruitment, police reform in general in this country cost a lot of money. And this is one instance where you have a cost saving opportunity, right?
Yes.
And maybe you mentioned also the involvement of the military in part of the training, which might also have saved money.
It did, very much.
Do you have any other examples that you can think of?
That there. My officers, as the UN commissioner, I did not have any authorization to spend 10 cents. to buy a stamp to send a letter to the United Nations, etc. My officers would get a flat tire somewhere along the road. Okay. They could stop there and get one of these fellas along the road, there's lots of them, he'd repair the tire right away and pay whatever, 10 gourds, 15 gourds, whatever it was. They would come into Capese, where there was an administrative officer. They put an administrative officer, and if he hadn't approved it, it wouldn't get paid. In some cases, he refused to pay it because they couldn't reach it, didn't contact him. This type of thing, that financial delegation has to be given to the commissioner and to the UN commander. I'm not asking for a lot of money, but to operationally to make things happen quickly, so that if a fella gets a flat tire, gets it fixed, has a receipt, send it in. I mean, if there's a pattern of you know, continuous flat tires, then maybe there's a problem with the person. We have to look at it. But I mean, you have to have a bit of risk management on that. But to pay an admin officer outside of the norms and put him out in the country for this type of thing, you know, we're wasting a lot of money that could be generated somewhere else to make the mission work.
Any reflection on the thinking on the ways to enhance accountability, external accountability and effectiveness, accountability to the community, but also to policymakers for the police?
Another thing we had working was a community-based policing. We had started that concept. The Canadians had that in place from our own country. The majority of the contributing countries were not involved in that type of policing. And when you talk about accountability, you're accountable to the area you police, because you're having different people participate and you're asking for different things to be looked after. I'm not saying that they're responsible for your performance. That's the commissioner's job to make sure that happens, and the police force has a commissioner, etc. So there are mechanisms to check how these things happen and what's going on. That didn't happen because, again, when I left, the idea of community-based policing was thrown out the window because they didn't believe in it. People didn't want it done. The commissioner stopped that as well. So the walks through the market, okay, the biking through the markets, and which had never happened before, had begun with the interim public security force and stayed with the new police force. But after February 29, 1996, a lot of that stuff was scrapped and nobody went anywhere. Stayed in the police station playing dominoes and drinking coffee like the fought in former years. So putting things in place, the commissioner has to have, if you want, the United Nations commissioner has to have more authority. I guess what I'm saying, okay, before a commissioner or chief of police of the home country is put into place, perhaps the United Nations commissioner should be in charge of the police for 4 or 5 years to get it going, okay, to make sure it's going and working.
Should be in charge of the national police with an executive mandate.
Yeah, the national police has to be not controlled but managed by someone who's been there before, has the experience, the worldly experience, or the of managing people and getting things done right, and it has to be done by someone, I think, outside of the home country. I think this is the mistake we're making in a lot of areas, a lot of countries. That's what I believe.
Yeah. Since then, there've been more examples of this, like executive mandate in Sierra Leone or in Kosovo or Timor Leste.
Yeah, and, so. Yeah. And if you'd like, I can give you some stuff on community-based policing. I can send it to you by email. The programs we have in place.
Link, maybe related to this in some ways. It's often. Often said that a politically neutral police is quite important. What was your experience of maybe depoliticizing the national police?
When the Nepali, Mr. Irish did felt that that the Fod were the remnants of Papa Doc and Baby Doc, and that if he allowed all of them to stay, that he would be overthrown. I think a lot of them, were removed, but I think there were some very, very good people that should have remained.
They were vetted out.
After the vetting, yeah, they were good managers, and they got things done, and they knew what had to be done. Whereas a lot of our young officers hadn't walked the talk, and got their heads inflated, if you want, and the authority went with it too. And that's the problem with some of these things. You have to have people with that have been there. And have to stay there for 4 or 5 years to get them going. I know it's going to ask a lot of the individual who would be chairing that, but if he knew that after 5 years he would be on his way, the job would get done, and I think get done well.
Taking a step back now, and we've talked about different technical areas, and I'd like to ask you about the broader challenges of police reform in the whole. And if there are any specific tasks from your experience that you think should be done in priority when looking at reforming national police?
Reforming.
Your experience.
Well, it's not just the police. It goes all the way up to the top spectrum. They have to be trained as well, be it the president, the minister of justice, they have to be on board, and their real true color has to be forthcoming. Because if they don't change, if they're not prepared to change their attitudes and culture, then it doesn't matter what we do in the police and the justice system, it'll never change, because those people will set the tone. I'm convinced. If they would change, rank and file will change. And Mr. Prevett, I'll tell you this, Mr. Prevett, when he became president, attempted to change a number of things. But the Senate and the House, the Commons, were all Lavalas. Okay? Aristid followers.
In Haiti.
Aristid told him to vote against whatever it was that Prevett put forward. And that's what happened. Prevett never passed one thing while he was there. He tried to take the country out of the business. There's a different sugar business and stuff like that, and he wanted to privatize it. And while Aristide was there or on the sidelines, it never passed. So that's what I'm trying to say, is that if the culture, the mentality doesn't change, nothing else is going to change. Because I think they put in two directors of policing. Disaster. He looked after himself. Set up his own security system for the rich.
Now moving away from the national police, I'd like to come back to something you've already started talking about as we were talking to Haiti, the actual UN police. And I'd like to ask you if you had maybe some recommendations for improving recruitment and find the right match of skills for the missions.
Okay. First of all, there's an excellent book that has been written by the Red Cross, to protect. That should be a requirement to be read. And the police officers should be tested on that. Okay. Now, don't make a standard test. I think the tests have to be changed every time that there's going to be one, so that you can avoid the problems that you may anticipate. A lot of police forces do not have a a code of conduct. And the United Nations passed a code of conduct in 1979, 8 articles. I'll send that to you too, okay? And that would be a big starting point, that those 8 articles be part of the training for anybody coming on mission in their own country. Because it's been translated in 6 official languages. It's English, French, Spanish, Chinese, Arab, and Russian. So it's available, and the home country should be a requirement. Whether they do it, how do we check it? We don't know. That's the other thing. How are we going to check if these people have been trained or understand a code of conduct? Are we going to wait till they come on mission? Or do we send people out? That's costly too. So how do we do this? How do we correct that? Maybe by long distance learning, by the internet, maybe that's an answer. I'm not sure, but how do we apply it, and how do we test it? That those are the type of things that we have to understand. But that, in my mind, is one of the things that has to be taught. Because, as I mentioned to you, the contributing nations watching this guy getting hit and beaten up, he says, well, you know, that's normal in my country. So when you're drawing, and, you know, you don't have a choice. You have to take what's given to you. And those become your police officers. But I think one of the things to overcome some of the difficulties is to blend your forces. And what I mean by blend, you mix them all up. You don't allow the Argentinians to be together, like the military work in contingents, because that's how they operate. We're dealing day to day with the general population, and they look to us for leadership in a lot of cases and examples. So it's important that you kind of mix your contingents, and of course, I mixed them for the language aspect, so they make sure that they understood. And I'm sure that a lot of these things that different countries do rub off on each other, how we do things. And I would hope that the best would be related back to the police forces to take back home.
Are there any innovation or experiments that you know about that you've actually implemented yourself while you were in Haiti? That you think that we haven't talked about, and that you think merit attention, things potentially that could be transferred. Also, if any of this initiative maybe were homegrown, is there any particular?
I mentioned the field service training. I think that's very, very important. Another thing that is the community-based policing aspect, because we expect our officers to live amongst the population. The mission. In Haiti, I had certain contingents that went and lived in the away from the community. I mean, miles away, an hour and a half away, Club Med type of things, okay? And they're there just for the money and couldn't care less about the country. And that has to be one of the things that should be ingrained, that you will live amongst the community, in order to be seen as part of the community, not away from it. I think that's very important, and I don't think enough is said about that. I know that things, different parts of the world are more hot than others, and I think you have to adjust to that situation.
Security environment.
Yeah, but generally, I think if we're going to try and get policing done, we the UN, have to live amongst the population to show example, because we're going to get involved in doing different things, coaching kids. You know, that's part of our part of the things we do, or we should do. And I had a program in Haiti with soccer, and I got equipment sent from Canada, used equipment, but we sent it to all the places, and the kids could have this stuff, and getting the kids involved in coaching, and police were doing the coaching, police were doing the refereeing, and we're doing exhibition games, that type of thing. But then we got another problem. One of the fathers come up to one of my officers and said, well, we had to get permission to transport the kids in police vans to another place to avoid the problem. So they would sign paper saying that the UN wouldn't be responsible. So one father said, well, how much will I get if my son falls off the truck and loses a leg or something like that? Or how much will you do this? And we said, well, nothing. Then he kept asking it up. He said, well, no, this is why you're signing this. You're not going to get anything. He kept it up, so we just canceled the game to protect ourselves, because we know that there Haitians have gone to Haiti from Canada and America and have had a limb removed, okay? Coming back to Canada saying that they were involved in an accident and lost a limb, but it had been surgically removed. I mean, it was fixed up and claimed for insurance. We had insurance investigators come to Haiti and saw us and wanted to go to different places so they could talk and interview people because of the situation. So these are the other things that come into mind. So, yeah.
Well, before we wrap up, are there any specific points that we haven't touched on that you'd like to come back to? And maybe if you had to write a handbook, I mean, we've just talked about a lot of these things, what are some general thoughts or maybe even topics that you would consider most important for future UN commissioners who will go and conduct police reform?
Code of conduct, that is a basic requirement. Understanding the legal systems of the world, because we come from common law. Some people come from Napoleonic Code, continental law, the Chirac, all different. And I think the people coming from any police officer coming to a mission should understand that. Whether he's from Canada, Jordan, Bangladesh, he should understand the different concepts of law that he of the officers he'll be working with, and he should understand as well as what is the legal system that's going to be in place in that particular country, so he'll have his mind tuned into it. But I think it's very important that they understand that, and that I think is one of the not downfall, but it would simplify that person's work a little more. And the concept of community-based policing, I think that's got to be put in. A lot of people don't believe in it, but I think if you want the people on side to understand, you have to be involved with them. Okay, but officers definitely have to know the code of conduct and human rights. Okay, in that book, To Protect, To Serve and To Protect, that is all in there: humanitarian law, human rights, etc. It's a very good book for the police.
All right, Neil Poilievre, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts.
You're welcome.